This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Dahlia Lithwick joins me live in studio. She's a columnist with Newsweek and a senior editor at slate.com. January 21st, the Supreme Court makes this ruling, and the shockwaves go out across the globe. Where were you when you first heard about this? Then the ruling, of course. Well, tell us what it is, and where were you when you heard about it?
It was the Citizens United case, and it was the campaign finance reform case that everybody was waiting to sort of hear whether the Supreme Court was finally going to sort of deal the death blow to this key provision of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law that made it impermissible for corporations to use money from their corporate treasuries to fund, quote, electioneering ads. Those are the kinds of ads that come within a 60 to 90 day period, depending on the election, that say that urge you to vote one way or another. And the question was, the court, the Roberts Court, had been sort of chipping away at McCain-Feingold, but they hadn't gone all the way. This was a big, big case, Citizens United, because it was a case that the court had heard last term. And then in June, instead of deciding the case, and you may remember, it was a very, very narrow issue last term. It was this movie, Hillary the Movie, and the question was whether it was a completely kind of deranged anti-Hillary Clinton's screed. And the question was whether that was electioneering that could be prescribed under McCain-Feingold. There was a very easy way for the court to decide that. They could have just narrowly looked at the movie and said, this isn't what we're talking about when we think about attack ads. But the court surprised everyone last June by saying, you know, we want to take another look at all of, you know, the big, big issues here about whether the provision itself is completely unconstitutional. They held it over. It was re-argued in September in a special session, Sonia Sotomayor's first day on the bench. And then, I guess, as you said, it was a shockwave because they decided this big, big case, 5-4, they decided that, in fact, they were going to strike down old case law, they were going to strike down this law that was popularly enacted, and that they were going to essentially say that corporations have the same speech rights as individuals for purposes of electioneering.
Hence the, we're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and Newsweek, hence the title of your column for Slate a couple weeks ago, The Pinocchio Project, which you watching as the Supreme Court turns a corporation into a real live boy.
Right. Well, I should tell you that I was, in fact, in the chamber at the Supreme Court as they announced this decision. One of the things that's always very tricky about the court is they don't tell you when cases are coming down. You're always sort of, is it today? Is it today? In this case, everybody expected, because it was heard in September, that we'd get a decision in November, you know, some point late in November. We were waiting and waiting. And there were a couple of days there in December, Coy, where everybody was coming to court, the press corps. They would announce the decisions. It wouldn't be Citizens United. We'd all sit around for 5 minutes and then, you know, go get drunk. There's nothing to do for day after day after day. We knew, because the court announced that they were going to have a special session. So we knew that it was coming down right when it did. And the thing that I really noticed sitting there hearing the justices read their opinions was, one, how very, very certain that Anthony Kennedy, who wrote the majority portion of this opinion, he really did feel like McCain-Feingold and these provisions that were trying to regulate ads by corporate money before elections, he really felt that fundamentally was a ban. He used the word ban over and over. So the fact that you could use your PAC money to do this, it wasn't a complete ban. You just had to use your PAC money, and you couldn't do it just within these sort of certain days before elections. That wasn't what he saw as permissible regulation. He saw that as an all-out ban. And I think the really critical thing to understanding his thinking is that it rested in two metaphors. One is that corporations are people. That corporations are people too, yeah. Which is the Pinocchio part of it, and two, that corporate money is speech. That it's so. Those are both.
This
metaphors.
Decision hinges on those two assumptions,
right? Well, yeah. And then a third assumption, which is even more complicated, which is that there's this marketplace of ideas, and that anything that you do to sort of think of it as in economic terms, anything you do to regulate speech in that marketplace somehow is sort of anti-competitive. And so it's a bunch of metaphors. And even Justice, then Chief Justice Rehnquist himself said, this is a metaphor. You know, this isn't the law. But what we saw the court do by a 5-4 decision was to turn this metaphor into the truth. The other thing I want to just
Just like they turned Jefferson's metaphor of a wall of separation between church and state, that became
a legal truth.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So I think that, you know, no matter what you feel about this case, it's really important to see what happens when the court reifies something that's kind of a legal fiction, a figure of speech, if you will, into constitutional law. And like I said, the reason it was so dramatic was they had to strike down cases that they had heard only recently. They had to strike down McCain-Feingold. It was very dramatic. And the court essentially said, sometimes, you know, we got it wrong, we're getting it right. And that was, I think, what was so dramatic. The other thing I just want to flag for your listeners is that polling is showing that while Americans cannot agree on anything beyond the fact that they like cheese and, you know, they like Evan Lysacek, they could agree on nothing. 80% of Americans in a new ABC Washington Post poll think this was a bad decision. So they have managed to do what nobody else can do, which is unite almost everybody against the court.
The extreme right, the extreme left are on the same page with this. The vast majority, 8 out of 10 Americans, don't like this decision.
It's a dramatic moment, and I don't think that the court anticipated it. You may remember there was that moment in Obama's State of the Union, Coy, where Obama went after the court and literally said they've opened the floodgates, you know, to corporate spending. And Alito, sitting there right in front of him, mouthed the words, it's not true, and sort of scandal ensues, both because here's the president taking on the court, which doesn't happen that often.
Now, help me out. I've read since then that the people, the fact checkers, the independent fact checkers, have looked into this and said that there's more truth with Obama on that than Alito.
Well, part of the real problem with Citizens United is nobody knows exactly what is going to happen. There are real questions here about how this is going to play out in the coming years. There are states that have allowed this kind of campaign spending. They haven't seen the kinds of multi-billion dollar, you know, Exxon takes over the elections that the liberals are warning about. But at the same time, it is certainly the case that there's nothing in here that says that foreign money cannot be used in American elections. I think that was the basic point that Obama was trying to make, although I think he overstated it. So between him and Alito, there is this factual question of how this will play out. That was what Obama was warning about. And we just don't know. I think that the thing that is important here isn't exactly how this is going to play out in future elections. It's that the Supreme Court took it upon itself to strike down a very, very popular properly enacted law of Congress. There were, you know, thousands of pages of congressional findings here. And the court took it upon itself to strike down its own precedent because the composition of the court has changed,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Sandra Day O'Connor's out, Alito's in. That's what changed in this time. And I think that the American people are quite horrified at what looks like a very, very activist act by the court. Here's the court. There were 100 narrower ways to decide this case and leave for another day the question of the constitutionality of McCain-Feingold and the electioneering provisions. What was dramatic was the court said, oh, come back and argue it again in September and let's really whack the heck out of this thing.
I mean, if we ever needed proof that the Supreme Court is truly driven, or if, I don't know if that's the right word, by politics, I mean, this is it.
I think people
like
it.
You change the political makeup of the court and they request, bring us this case so we can make a different decision. And, you know, we're going to totally change the law and change precedent.
I think that's right. People likened this to Bush v. Gore. And I think not entirely inaptly said this was a purely political decision. And the reason I think you're seeing right and left rallying against it is that this was just a terrible piece of timing on the court to say, screw populist sentiment in America. We're going to make sure that big, big multi-million dollar corporations have as much right to influence elections as an actual living, breathing human being. I don't think that was a message that was going to play all that well 3 years ago. But to launch a message like that in the middle of a recession, after the bailouts, after the bank bonuses, at a moment when Americans are more suspicious than they've ever been of big money and politics, the court just seemed to me to be at bottom utterly tone deaf.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and Newsweek, honored to have her live in studio. You can read her recent work online at Slate.com. www.cnnnews.com. We're going to take a break for local news and weather. When we get back, I want to talk about this idea that a corporation is treated now by the Supreme Court as a person. They have established law that this fake person is a real person and entitled to all the protections in the First Amendment, which blows my ever-loving mind that we live in America and that has become law, that a corporation is now legally a person and has personhood. It's just amazing. And we'll also talk about the rumors now swirling around Washington that we may be looking at two new vacancies on the Supreme Court, which you want to talk about shockwaves around the world. That would be something. We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick live in studio. We'll take a break for local news and weather. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
Ask America's seniors what they think about health care reform, and they'll tell you.
On the News Radio 1070 WYNA Local Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Frank Strait. Patchy clouds and cold overnight with the low 24. Several hours of sun on Saturday with a decent afternoon, high 46. Saturday night, partly cloudy, low 26. Sun will mix with clouds on Sunday. It'll be a mild day, up around 50, but then a cold rain for Monday, high near 40, partly sunny on Tuesday with a high 46. Dependable weather 24 hours a day. This is News Radio 1070 WYNA.
Here's a story of a lovely lady.
It's 46 degrees in Central Virginia at 35 minutes past 4 o'clock, 25 before 5. Coming up in the next hour, we'll talk live in studio with Hawes Spencer of The Hook. There's a sick homicidal maniac killer who's loose in Charlottesville. That, according to the Harringtons, who lost their daughter. And they insist that her killer lives among us. That topic for the next hour. Let's rejoin our conversation with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and Newsweek. You can read her most recent work online at slate.com. So I want to know, when did corporations become people? Because that's literally what has happened. The Supreme Court ruled on January 21st that a corporation, this fictive, imaginary conglomerate of people come together to make money, is now a person unto itself and entitled to everything in the Bill of Rights.
You sound like Justice John Paul Stevens, boy, who, you know, was 89 years old. He's been on this court for every one of these campaign finance cases and basically sat there and read. It's very dramatic. He read his dissent from the bench, which happens very, very rarely that a justice is so exercised that they want to read from the bench. And he read it in this sort of quavering voice. You know, he was clearly, I want to say, perfectly clearly, there's nothing wrong with his mind. He is sharper at 90 than I am, you know, at much younger. But he was, you know, mixing up words and tripping over himself and thumping on his microphone. He was so distraught. And essentially, he was making exactly the point you're making. Corporations are not people. They don't vote like people. They don't think like people. In fact, they aggregate themselves together so that they're not people, right? That's the point of a corporation, is that it doesn't have the responsibilities of personhood. And in his opinion, he goes out of his way to say, look, we've always regulated corporations differently than we have individuals. And he flicks at Thomas Jefferson, who famously fretted that corporations would subvert the republic, right? Talks
yeah.
about how worried the framers were about unfettered corporate power, and talks about how corporations were conceptualized to be quasi-public entities, never to be private entities with all the you know, benefits of personhood. And he says it's always clear, if you look right back at the framers, that when the First Amendment was ratified, it gave First Amendment privileges to individuals, not to corporations. It was always understood that corporate speech could be regulated. And so he really, as you do, says it's fine and well to say that we've had this notion that decades now, that corporations have some certain rights and privileges, but they are not people and they shouldn't have greater or similar rights to individuals. And he really bemoans it when he says even the Rehnquist Court wasn't willing to go nearly this far in their campaign finance cases. And so what we saw was a change, not in the law, not in corporations, but a change in the composition of the court that suddenly wanted to reach way back and confer upon corporations exactly the same rights free speech rights that individuals have. So really, he's as horrified as you were. And it was very, very powerful and really quite visceral to see him on the bench essentially saying the only thing that has changed is this court.
Yeah.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and Newsweek. So what's been the fallout? What's the reaction, you think?
Well, as I said, the polling has been shockingly. I who thought when this came down and I said this is not going to go over well in a moment of a recession where people really hate Congress, they hate big business, and the idea that those two entities are going to collude to make sure that their voices aren't heard could not be more ill-timed. But I think even I am surprised at the ferocity of the blowback, and as you said it, how bipartisan it is. I mean, this is an issue that the right and the left really can get together on. And I think it really dovetails with, as you said, some real suspicion about the Roberts Court. The Roberts Court, remember, is supposed to be dedicated to principles of calling balls and strikes, being neutral umpires. Chief Justice John Roberts has famously said, I'm a minimalist. I'm humble. I do as little as I have to do, right? We get in, we get out.
This is the very definition of an activist court. I mean, this is unbelievable. Bring us this case. We'll make a very 5-4, very political decision that completely changes the nature of democracy in America. This is unreal.
I think that's right. I think it puts the lie to the notion that only liberals are activists. An activist is anybody who, I mean, by every single metric that you can use to define judicial activism, and I've said to you before, I hate that term. I think it's a conclusory term that means nothing except I don't like the outcome. But by any academic measure of activism, whether it's striking down duly enacted laws, whether it's striking down precedent, whether it's reaching beyond what you have to, this is one of the most activist decisions you've ever seen. And so what the Roberts Court says is, well, it's not activist when we do it. When we do it, we're just fixing the law. But I think, as you say, plainly and on its face, whether you agree with this or not, there were 100 ways to decide Citizens United that were not this dramatic and not this consequential and that are not going to, I think, fundamentally alter the role of corporation and corporate money in our electoral
process. Well, it's not illegal when the president does it.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, even a cursory reading of American history will tell you that one of the most critical things that we revolted against in the 1770s was the collusion between big business and government in England. That we just had it, that we could see that that was destroying the marketplace, it was destroying liberty, that big business was controlling government. And that's what the Boston Tea Party was all about. You know, I mean, that was so embedded in everything that we fought against. And here we are, hundreds of years later, recreating old England.
And systemically, I mean, I think that there's no better evidence of the problem that the Congress itself passed this legislation, right? That senators are saying, please don't make me indebted to Exxon. You know, don't make me indebted to big business because I don't want to have to legislate looking over my shoulder to see whether big corporations, whether it's big pharma, big oil, is going to be running a commercial next November that says don't vote for him because he did X.
Yeah.
So when you have Congress itself saying take this money out of the picture, I think that that really speaks to how embedded the problem is. And, you know, there's a bunch of different legislative fixes that are floating around out there. I'm moderating a panel next week in D.C. that's sort of looking at this question of can we fix this legislatively. I think there's a sense that it's, you know, rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic because short of amending the Constitution to expressly say, you know, that this is not corporate speech that can't be regulated. I think that there is going to be a massive infusion of corporate money. Although, as I said, I think we want to be very careful to see how this plays out because there are a lot of very, very smart political thinkers who say this may not be the sky is falling. We just need to wait and see.
Yeah. We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and Newsweek. Now, before we let you go, I want to hear all the rumors that are going around Washington that we could be looking at not one, but two Supreme Court vacancies this summer. I mean, that's just as shocking as that January 21st decision.
I have to cancel my vacation plans. You know, you never know what's going to happen. Here's what we know for sure. We know that Justice John Paul Stevens is 90. He seems to be as fit as he's ever been. I've talked to his clerks. They say, you know, he could still whoop you in tennis if you're 18 years old. We do know, however, and he hasn't contradicted this, he only hired one clerk for next fall. So that's what you do when you take senior status. And so he's
so that's a good sign
telegraphing pretty unequivocally that he's looking to get out. The other thing we know is that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's 74, has fought with pancreatic cancer this past year, and that she looks frail. Now, all of a sudden last week, a big ABC story exploded that said the White House is looking to fill two slots this summer. Whether or not that's true, and there's also, I should add one more piece of information, which is there's an unwritten rule at the Supreme Court that they don't do two retirements at the same time. They try very hard, and as you may recall, that's why O'Connor retired the year she retired. She had wanted to retire the following year, talked to then Chief Justice Rehnquist, who was very sick with thyroid cancer. He said, I'm not going. She said, then I'm going to go now. You go next year. And then they both ended up leaving. As you recall, she left and he
died. But it's not a rule. It's just a custom,
right? It's a custom because they know how disruptive it is, particularly in a year like this, going to be before the midterm election. So I think my own suspicion is that a lot of this is scuttlebutt and panic and worry. And it's teeing up a question of, who's Obama going to put up? Is he going to put up the liberal answer to Scalia? Is he going to put up another moderate like Sotomayor? If he gets two spots, does he put up one to mollify the liberals and one to mollify the Republic? So it tees up a whole lot of very interesting strategic parlor games. But my own sense is you have two justices who are fit and reasonably healthy. They're going to, I think, collude to not do two at the same time. So my sense is that this is a rumor. It's an interesting sort of thought experiment. I think we're going to see Ginsburg go next year and probably Stevens go this year.
Interesting. We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick. And based on what we've seen of Obama thus far, he's not likely to put up the liberal answer to Scalia. I mean, he's more than likely, in all probability, it would just be another moderate, which, of course, goes against everything the extreme conservatives said during the election. This is the most liberal senator in the history of the Senate, which literally isn't true when you look at, you know, some of the decisions that he's made. And he's made those extreme liberals in America very angry and very disappointed.
I think that's right. I mean, two points. One, replacing the very liberal Stevens and the quite liberal Ginsburg is not going to affect the net composition of the court. This isn't going to be an interesting conversation about the court until Kennedy goes, right? He's the fifth justice. He was the decisive vote in Citizens United and Boumediene and every major case you and I have talked about. That's going to be an interesting confirmation hearing. This is replacing liberals with, as I think you're exactly correct, slightly less liberal liberals. It's not going to affect the net composition of the court. So what becomes interesting is you have the left saying, we have no Scalia. We have no Roberts. We don't even have a Kennedy. You know, we want someone on the left who's young and energetic and who has a very, very exciting constitutional vision that they're willing to articulate and support instead of these sort of moderate technocrats that we call liberals on the court. And it's really clear that every single person who has been replaced at the court for the last couple of decades has been replaced by someone to their right. The court has moved dramatically to the right. We haven't seen anybody replaced by somebody who's more liberal than themselves. And Justice David Souter, who left last year, clearly replaced by Sotomayor to his right. So I think that it's a trend that we're seeing, and I think you're quite right that Obama is probably unlikely to reverse that trend. I think he's going to try. If he had an opportunity to put the liberal Scalia up, he would have done it last summer when he had 60 votes and a lot of, I think, public, you know, capital.
Yeah,
he doesn't have that now. This is not his fight.
Interesting. Last question. There's a major announcement expected in just a few minutes regarding torture. Is that right?
Yeah. This is a report that they've been sitting on at the Justice Department for years now, Coy. And it is the ethics division's look at the legal memos that were done supporting torture, supporting warrantless wiretapping. So basically looking at the architecture, the legal architecture of the war on terror.
It must not be good if they're releasing this at 5 o'clock on a Friday.
And that's really all you need to say. The Justice Department has been sitting on this forever. Eric Holder promised it was coming out in November. Then he promised December. This is going to be, was supposed to be, the Justice Department spanking John Yoo and Jay Bybee for the legal work that they did that shored up some of the most lawless action in the Bush administration. Everything that I've heard says it's not going to spank them. It might be a little tiny rap on the knuckles. But I think there was a hope that there would be calls for their disbarment, calls for serious consequences. But what we're hearing now, the preliminary reports in the last couple of weeks have suggested that that report that was initially very critical, and this is of their lawyering skills, not the conclusions, but just whether this was good lawyering that said that waterboarding is legal and that if the president does it, it's okay. It looks as though they're going to get a pass.
Again, another sign that this is not the most liberal administration in the history of America, which is what, you know, the conservatives were saying before the last election. Oh, be careful, be careful. The most liberal administration would have gotten in and had hearings about those decisions. Now they just, you know, drop a report out at 5 o'clock on a Friday that it sounds milquetoast, you know, there's nothing to it.
And it really comes the same week that Dick Cheney said, on the talk shows last weekend, I was for waterboarding. So when you have the former vice president saying, I was supported this action that by convention, by international law, by domestic statute is illegal and it's a felony. And when he's owning it and you're saying that the lawyers who made it legal did nothing wrong, I think you're quite right that the Obama administration has not. You know, they've said they are opposed to torture. They've certainly repealed the parts of the laws that make it equivocal. But in terms of looking backward at how we became a nation that waterboarded people, the Obama administration is no more interested in exploring those problems than the Bush administration was.
She is a senior editor at Slate.com and a columnist for Newsweek. You can read her most recent work online at Slate.com. Dahlia Lithwick. Thank you, Dahlia, so much.
It's always a pleasure. Have a good weekend.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit sevillepodcast.com for more.